fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end, no safety or surprise, the end, I'll never look into your eyes again.
Welcome to Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today we contemplate the end of human life on the planet Earth. What if the planet's most successful invasive species, Homo sapiens, simply disappeared? What would remain of our monuments and our cities and our works of art? How would the Earth's ecosystem respond? How long would it take for the Earth's climate to return to pre-industrial norms? And would the Earth and the remaining life on it be better off without us? That's the intriguing premise of a book written by our guest today, Alan Wiseman, The World Without Us, a book that's been translated into 30 languages and was named Best Nonfiction Book of 2007 by Time Magazine and Entertainment Weekly. It was number one on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list for 25 consecutive weeks. And Alan Wiseman's reports from around the world have appeared in Harper's, the New York Times Magazine, the Atlantic Monthly, the Los Angeles Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, and Audubon. And you've got a chance to see Mr. Wiseman this weekend at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, where he will be the keynote speaker Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock. And, of course, today as we explore the premise behind The World Without Us, we discuss environmental issues with Alan Wiseman. We invite you to be a part of that conversation. Please give us a call. Our lines are open to you at 261-6371, 261-6371, or toll-free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. Alan Wiseman joining us by telephone from his home in Massachusetts. And, Alan, thanks so much for making your time available for us this afternoon.
Pleasure.
What gave you the idea for this book?
Well, I have been writing about the environment probably for the last 20 years. I don't consider myself just an environmental writer, but more and more every story is an environmental story. And I got to a point where I had been to so many places in the world writing about environmental disasters, from the ozone hole in Antarctica to burning rainforest to Chernobyl, all kinds of lovely things on our continent, that I began to understand that these things were not separate, discrete events, but they were all connected somehow, and that somehow happened to always sluice through us. So given the privilege that I've had as a journalist of seeing so much of this stuff, I naturally decided, I want to put this all together into one place so I can describe what this connection's about. And that, though, led me to a dilemma that many environmental writers come up against, mm-hmm. which is to really explain the global environmental crisis. You need something book length. And yet, something as big as a planetary environmental crisis can be just so damn depressing or frightening that, who wants to read this? So a lot of environmental books only get read by people who already know this stuff. And given that the environment impacts everybody and that everybody is impacting the environment, I just decided I was not going to write another environmental book that only spoke to the same logical audience.
So how do you come up with this premise? It's a logical premise in a lot of ways, but it's one that we haven't seen before, and it certainly grabs you.
Well, what happened is I got a call from an editor at Discover Magazine one day, and she said, "Would you write a piece for us about what the world would be like without people in it?" And I said, "You mean like what's going to be left when we eat ourselves into extinction and drag down all these other species with us. It's going to be like an empty lot. She says, no. I don't want that story. She says, I have to edit that story all the time. It's too depressing. I want to know what would happen if we just suddenly all left. And I said, no, that's very unlikely. And she said, I don't care. That's what I want. So I started thinking out loud, well, is this at all possible? Because I don't write science fiction. I'm a journalist. And I came up with, just thinking out loud, with a few scenarios that are remotely, very remotely possible, but theoretically they are possible.
Mm-hmm.
And in my book, I mean, I dispense with it in a single paragraph. I mean, say a Homo sapiens-specific virus like AIDS becomes airborne and we all get it, or say some evil genius injects something, nanoparticles or whatever, into the ecosystem and does something like sterilize our sperm, or, you know, space aliens or Jesus rapture us away. Anyhow, you get rid of us, and I begin to realize, now this gets really interesting, because suddenly the world's, you know, as we know it, just keeps going on without us, and yet it would have to contend with the things that we leave behind, which in a sense, you know, that's our environmental impact.
You know, the concept of a virus was actually the subject of a science fiction book, Kurt Vonnegut's Galapagos. I don't know if you read that or not, but the premise of that was that a virus was spread among the entire human race, which kept people from reproducing. And the only place it didn't hit were these travelers who got stranded on the island of Galapagos.
I never did read that. There was a book in 1948, which is in my bibliography, called Earth Abides by George Stewart. Wonderfully written novel, and it's kind of the same premise. I mean, you know, this is a premise that is going to occur from time to time to people.
Well, I'll tell you what, Alan.
I just wanted to explain that when this was suggested to me, I began to realize this is a really fascinating way of looking at the world. And I said to this editor, I said, how did you come up with this idea? She said, I got it from you. And I said, we've never spoken. She says, I know. But she says, I read the piece you did for Harper's in 1994 on Chernobyl, the aftermath of Chernobyl. She says, it was the most depressing thing I'd ever read. But over the years, it's kind of become the most hopeful thing I've read, because in it, I describe how, despite, you know, the radiation of the area, and there's this 10-kilometer wide zone around it that's, you know, completely devoid of human beings now, plants and animals have gone in there, and it looks really lush. The landscaping is overgrowing the houses. And she said, I decided that if, you know, that could, something that had been so contaminated by human beings, possibly the worst disaster in the history of humanity, you know, nature could recover so beautifully. Well, what would happen if we did it, you know, planet-wide?
Well, Alan,
it had never occurred to me to take this concept, you know, to
the
a
logical
global
extreme.
Level.
Well, I want you to hold that thought. I'm going to take our break here, and when we come back, I want you to describe for us exactly what would happen to the typical suburban home in the average suburban subdivision, and also one of our great cities. In the event that human beings simply disappeared. Alan Wiseman with us on Route 51, talking about the end of the world.
Go on shining. Why does the sea rush to shore?
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
Alan, let's say all the people in the world suddenly disappear. What happens to the average suburban home in the average suburban subdivision? And how long does it take for nature to reclaim its territory?
Well, you know, the first thing that happens is the thing gets really quiet because all the engines stop operating rather soon. And all the maintenance that human beings typically perform on anything, be it a house, be it the infrastructure of a city or a power plant or whatever, that ceases. And in the cases of our houses, you know, they point out in the book, you know, when you bought your house, they never told you that nature was going to try to repossess it long before the bank. And
well, that's the truth.
Yeah, if you own a home, I mean, you're constantly fighting against nature. I mean, we just patched more holes in the roof here recently, and sooner or later, you know, water is going to start to get into a house. You know, your roof, even if it's brand new, it will be compromised within two or three decades. And once water starts getting in, I had a lot of fun. I interviewed a whole bunch of architects who all got together in one room, and they started talking about how to unbuild a house. And everybody started on the roof with a roof leak because water starts getting in around the nail holes, and the nails rust, and the rust expands them, and then pretty soon it loosens their grip, and the structural integrity of the roof starts to, and then the wall starts to give way.
And we don't exactly build them like we used to in the pre-industrial era.
That's part of it. I mean, as I explored this further, it turns out that human architecture is kind of this bell-shaped curve. You know, we started in caves, and then we started making artificial caves, heaping up stones to give us rock walls around us. And those stone buildings, particularly the ones that we fit so well, we didn't even need mortar like Machu Picchu, those are the ones that are going to last the longest, and those are some of the earliest ones. So our newest architecture, these glass and steel towers that we create, they are structurally extremely vulnerable to the elements.
Well, let's talk about that next, but just to wrap up the talk about the average suburban house, how long before the average American's prized possession, his home, virtually disappears, the roof falls in, the walls collapse, and we're back to nature?
If it's frame construction, which is the predominant architectural form that you find in Wisconsin, within a century most of it's going to be lying on the ground. The chimney might still be there, but bricks are going to be dropping out because the mortar's crumbling. Your bathroom tile lasts longer than anything because it's chemically very similar to a fossil. All these artificial things like vinyl siding and hardy planks that they are supposed to be indestructible, they're not, believe me. Aluminum is the one thing we don't know how long it will last because it's so new. So all those bathroom fixtures, you know, like the runner along your shower door, it may last in a few thousand years. But if you look at yours, you'll already see little chemical pits forming in it. It's a house that goes unmaintained. Unless someone's really lucky, within a century, most of it's down.
Well, let's look at our pride and joy in America, our big cities, New York City. When we look at the concrete and steel edifices, the 100-story buildings, that looks pretty permanent and impenetrable. But in your book, you describe a disintegration that's really breathtakingly quick. You say it starts from what you call the city's soft underbelly.
When I went to New York, which I picked because it's kind of the archetypical, you know, the artificial landscape, and everybody in the world has either been there or they've seen it in films. And I asked everybody, be they architects or civil engineers or biologists, urban planners, I asked them all the same question. Could this city ever revert to being a forest the way it was when Henry Hudson first saw it in 1609 with just a few Native Americans around the edges? And unanimous, it not only would, but it will someday all be a forest again. That underbelly is the subway system. Manhattan used to be this really hilly island. It had about 40 streams and rivers draining the island of the sea. The hills all got mashed down when they superimposed the grid on the city in the 19th century, and that buried all those rivers. that, along with the normal groundwater in a rainy climate, it's similar to Wisconsin again, means that the subway engineers have to pump, even on a sunny day, 13 million gallons of water.
And the subway, the subways are actually built under the sewers, right, which are kind of our substitute for the naturally occurring rivers.
Yeah, exactly. And we never quite mimic nature, or we try to mimic nature, but we can't ever do it quite as efficiently as nature does it. And, of course, the subways being under the sewers then are under the water table. So they're surrounded by water. In some cases, there are actual underground rivers that they are contending with. And
you know, one of the most striking parts of that chapter was when you described these two engineers looking down and just hundreds, thousands of gallons of spring water bubbling up from the ground, and that's something they have to contend with every day just to keep the subways from flooding as it is.
Yeah, it's fabulous. I mean, these guys crawled me around underneath Manhattan and Brooklyn and showed me places where there's bedrock outcropping in the tunnels, and there's water just gushing forth, and they keep 800 pumps going, and they have to pump uphill, of course. And then whenever it's raining out, then their job becomes twice as hard. And when there is a storm at sea, and there frequently are, and just, you know, rising seas, which are getting, you know, more chronically now because of climate change, that puts more pressure on the water table, and that just pushes more water. In fact, during a storm when over 2 inches of water, 2 inches of rain falls, some of the subways, like the one around Yankee Stadium, they flood. And so they're looking at more and more of this.
So say we lost all the people in New York and the pumps stopped running. There was no electricity. There was nobody to run those hoses and pump it all out. How long would it take for the subways to flood, the streets above them to collapse, and everything to become rivers once again?
Well, they told me that it would take 2 to 3 days for the subways to flood. And then for a while, not too much would happen. But the steel columns that are holding up the roof, which is the street, they would start to corrode, and civil engineers pretty much agreed that within 2 decades, 20 years, some of them would start to collapse, and they would buckle, and then the streets would cave in, and we'd have rivers on the surface of Manhattan again. And that, you know, this becomes you know, sort of like a cataclysm where just one thing touches off another. The foundations of skyscrapers in New York are anchored into New York Manhattan schist, but they were not designed to be waterlogged. And as they destabilized and as a hurricane struck the island, which it has from time to time and probably will get more in the future, a building, when it topples, is going to take down a lot of other buildings the same way that a tall tree, when it falls in the forest, takes down a lot of other trees.
How long before the skyscrapers start falling?
Oh, probably within a century there would be skyscrapers falling. It could happen even sooner if some foundation got particularly waterlogged and destabilized and a big hurricane comes.
And long before that, you'd have plants, shrubs, and trees begin growing again on city streets.
Yeah, every spring, plants and trees start growing up through the cracks in the sidewalk. Seeds will lodge in them, and maintenance crews have got to clear these things out. They poison them or they pull them. If they're not there, within 2-3 years, you're going to start seeing a lot of stuff, rooting itself. And you'll also have a lot of leaf litter in the streets. All the sewers are going to be clogged because of, you know, plastic bags flying around. And nobody's going to be raking up the leaf litter. And so seeds are going to be germinating in that stuff. And some of them can send roots right down through through asphalt and concrete. Hmm. And then within 5 to 10 years, 10 maximum, there'll be a lightning strike because there's no firemen around. You'll get a fire. And
it doesn't take long for the entire city to revert back to, a natural state. Well, what survives of ours? Do any of our artwork survive?
Yeah. Some of our more unpleasant things survive, like plastic is going to be around for a long time until microbes learn how to eat it.
What about the artwork in our museums?
Well, bronze is one of the most durable materials on the planet. It's a very successful human alloy. And it's, you know.
And as he's saying in the book, that's how we know about the Bronze Age.
Exactly. By the way, I don't say anything in the book. I went
you
all over the world
people.
Finding experts who told me what and explained to me how this stuff works. And that was an art conservator in New York City who told me that. So, you know, our bronze will probably be around for a long time. And at one point in the book, I speak to an artist who Carl Sagan hired to basically choreograph all the words and images and sounds that were inscribed onto these gold-plated long-playing records that were appended to the Voyager spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two sets of them that are off in interstellar space right now, carrying like Louis Armstrong's music and Mozart off into interstellar space.
And even some Chuck Berry on that
record. Yeah, they'll be around for at least a billion years. And possibly even longer than that, though, radio waves. I mean, we have been broadcasting them out into the universe, and though they become ever thinner and more tenuous.
But a lot of our great paintings are not going to last without us.
No. Paintings are probably not going to do very well. They're subject to mold. In museum vaults, most museum vaults are not so much watertight as they are temperature controlled.
Alan,
temperature controls all go.
We got to take a break for news, and we will be back on the other side with more from Alan Wiseman. He's the keynote speaker this Saturday afternoon at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair, talking about the world without us. 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742. Back after this.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UW Extension, Division of Continuing Education, Outreach, and E-Learning, now managing the online Bachelor of Science degree in Sustainable Management. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
That's great. It starts with an earth. Wait, birds and snakes and airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world to its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up an ox. Speed front. No strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Fight down high. Fire and a fire. Representatives have engaged in the government for hire and a combat site. Left to us and coming in a hurry with the fury speeding down your neck. Team, my team, reporters, battle Trump.
On Route 51 Regional Talk Radio, I'm Glenn Moberg, and Alan Wiseman is our guest, the author of The World Without Us. What would happen if all the people on the planet Earth simply disappeared? He's the keynote speaker Saturday afternoon at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin. He's our guest for the next half hour, and he's taking your phone calls at 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. Alan, we talked about how amazingly quickly New York City would reduce itself back to a somewhat natural state. We talked about the buildings, the works of art, and so on. What about the animals and the plants? What about our pet dogs?
Well, domesticated animals that have gotten too used to being around us and really depending on us probably aren't going to do very well. Dogs are going to get out competed by coyotes and wolves.
So you envision wolves back in New York City?
Oh, yeah. Wolves are here in Massachusetts where I am. They've been coming up through Minnesota, over the Great Lakes, down from Canada.
Yeah, the wolf population in Wisconsin is a big item of contention here as well. There are a number of people who think that we ought to have a hunting season because the population has recovered to the point where the DNR even says that there are too many wolves.
Well, all this just proves that this is a resilient species, that despite our efforts to exterminate it, has maintained itself, and it's going to do really well when we are gone.
So our pet dogs are competition for our feral ancestors.
No, a couple of the bigger ones or the more attractive ones might end up interbreeding with some of them.
How about the cats?
Well, cats are an interesting exception. I mean, anybody who's a cat owner knows that you don't really tame a cat. You know, cats tame us. They train us to bring them free food. But our house cats are genetically identical to a small furtive species of wild cat that exists around the Mediterranean basin, and you can feed your cat and put your cat outside, and the cat will immediately go into hunting mode when it sees a bird. Cats have done extremely well, they've been extremely successful in the wild. They live, in fact, there's a fabulous report from the state of Wisconsin. That
big feral cat population here.
In the book, yeah. But, you know, cats who live in rural areas, and of course there are urban cats that do very well in alleyways. Cats, like the pigs in Hawaii, these are animals that are here to stay. They have found their songbird-sized niche in the ecosystem, and they're out-competing weasels and other animals of a similar size.
What happens to our garden crops and our food? Corn, carrots, broccoli, cauliflower?
A lot of them are supposedly, according to botanists I've spoken to, they've been intensely bred, and they will revert back to their ancestral far less palatable versions within a very short time.
So carrots turn
the seeds have to be maintained.
Carrots turn into Queen Anne's lace, for instance?
Yeah, exactly. And broccoli goes back to something that doesn't look very much like broccoli at all.
It used to be a wild mustard root. From what I read somewhere. Well, how about all of the stuff that we put in the environment? The lead, the mercury, the plastics, the chemicals in the soil. Without us, how long before Mother Earth recovers some semblance of her pre-industrial self?
Well, in the case of heavy metals, they have been deposited, from the sky, from industrial and auto emissions, and they're in our agricultural chemicals, our agricultural soils, and now because of some of the things that we use to fertilize soil, such as toxic sludge, they tend to bind longer. And some of the studies that have been done on Europe suggest that these metals are going to hang around for thousands of years. I think lead's going to be around for 7,000 years. And lead is 35,000 years. I think it's chromium that can last up to 65,000 years. And ultimately, I think that these metals, rather than sluice or through drainage systems and finally be washed from the soil, are simply going to be buried by deposition of more organic matter on top of them. But we're talking a long time. This really will be into the thousands of years.
And how long to reverse global warming?
Well, that depends on when we stop stimulating it, which means when we stop putting carbon into the atmosphere. If humans disappeared tomorrow and nothing else went up our smokestacks or out our exhaust pipes, the consensus that I got from scientists when I was researching this book about 3 years ago was that to reabsorb everything that we have dug out of the ground over, say, the past few centuries and ejected in the atmosphere, we're probably looking at about 100,000 years. Now, because of turnover in the ocean, they estimated that much of that would take place, up to 80% of that, in the first 1,000 years. Now there's more data that are suggesting that it may take longer because higher turbulence in the atmosphere, more storms, means that winds are blowing harder over over the sea, and that impedes the ability of water to absorb carbon dioxide.
So ironically, our artwork, our monuments, all of the great works of man, the things that will persist the longest, is the crap that we put into the environment.
Well, that's probably true. You know, again, I think that radio waves may outlive everything. That includes the conversation that you and I are having here. But I think on the Earth itself, you know, we have become a geological force. We are like a sheet of ice or like several volcanoes that, you know, that would go off in the history of the young Earth. We are causing a huge ecological change. You know, many scientists describe it as the sixth great extinction in the history of the planet. I mean, fortunately, the planet has survived the previous five extinctions. It takes a long time, millions of years, but the planet always bounces back, and I don't think that we are going to destroy the Earth. But we are destroying the Earth as we know and love it, and you know, ultimately, that brings me to why did I write this book, which is not because I think that we should go away and I'm trying to show how awful we are. I think that we deserve to be here as much as any other species, but any species that gets too powerful and starts, you know, gobbling its entire resource base ultimately ends up doing itself in. It suffers a big population crash, and I would like to see us use the intelligence and the information that we have accrued to do the wise thing and to bring ourselves back into balance with nature. That's my hope for writing this book.
Alan Wiseman, the author of The World Without Us, he is the keynote speaker Saturday afternoon, 1 o'clock at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer. This is Route 51. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're taking your phone calls at 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to the phones. Greg and Tomahawk, you're on Route 51. Hello, Greg.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, my question to you, Mr. Wiseman, is this book, is this what the History Channel's program that's on Tuesday evenings, is this based on your book right now?
Let me answer carefully.
Okay.
That has been suggested by many people. It was not officially taken from my book. My book has been optioned by another production company, and the History Channel chose to do their own version.
Okay.
And, you know, you can't copyright an idea, so they are entitled to do that. I have intentionally not seen these programs, so I can't comment any further.
Okay, may I follow up with another question?
Yes, sure. Yes, you can.
Okay, thanks. About how long, then, the people that you spoke with, would it take for, like, the rivers, for instance, in northeastern Wisconsin, the Fox River, for itself to clean up rivers that have been polluted by PCB pollution and just other industrial sources of pollution? How long would that take? And I will gladly take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Alan, the Fox River, of course, polluted by a lot of the sludge and the stuff that's been excreted by paper mills throughout the years.
When there is no more toxic input to a river, depending on its, you know, its rate of flow, of course, can clean itself up, you know, rather quickly. It, you know, some things like the Housatonic that flows through Massachusetts, where I am right now, and, you know, in into the Hudson, carrying all those General Electric PCBs, it's going to take, you know, they say, you know, anywhere from a few hundred years on up for all of that to scour its bed. But more and more stuff gets deposited on top of that. Again, you know, some of our worst sins are probably going to be buried long before they're really cleaned up. And it, just like cleaning up emissions into Lake Erie brought it back from dead to a live lake again, rivers will have an opportunity to scour themselves off as long as we're not adding more agricultural chemicals and industrial chemicals into them.
Of course, the ironic thing is that rivers have that capability to flush themselves out, but it's some of our really pristine bodies of water, like Lake Superior, which even though it's certainly not polluted like the other lakes are, the pollution that's in there will take just about forever to get out because of just the way the lake is constituted.
Well, once again, a lot of that stuff is going to get buried. I mean, at one point, In Africa, in Lake Tanganyika, which is a far deeper lake than Lake Superior, there's a limnologist in my book who does lake core samples. And the lake bed deposits materials every year the same way that, you know, snowfall deposits it on glaciers. And lake core samples are even a truer and sometimes older gauge than the glaciers of Antarctica are for measuring ecological change.
And whereas Lake Superior has been around for, I think, what, 8,000-9,000 years, something like that, Lake Tanganyika is it's been around for a much longer period of time.
About 9 million years, and Lake Baikal in Siberia even a little older than that. So, you know, what we find is a whole human record, and even pre-human record, way down in these lake bottoms. And farther up, you find signs of agriculture, you find the Iron Age, you find the first nuclear blast, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But every year, more material gets laid on top of this stuff, and it gets, to the greatest extent, safely buried away. By the way, most of our rivers in the United States are dammed, and those dams, without human maintenance, at the outside are going to last a couple hundred years. They silt up, they spill over, the waterfall in front of the dam, when it starts spilling over, starts to excavate a hole, and eventually the dam falls, you know, it just collapses into it. And once rivers are wild and free, it's pretty magnificent what can happen.
Well, there's a local group, the River Alliance in Wisconsin, that's doing their best to speed up that process.
Well, there are opportunities, legal and otherwise, to speed up that process. I mean, lots of places where wind farms are going up, such as in Oregon, they're starting to question the need for some of the dams that have been there for a long time. And that, to me, is a positive opportunity.
Alan Wiseman, author of The World Without Us. We've got to take a quick break. A reminder, he's going to be speaking at 1 o'clock Saturday afternoon at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin. We're taking your phone calls at 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guest today, Alan Wiseman, the author of The World Without Us. Again, we're taking your phone calls at 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742. Alan, global warming, as you mentioned, is going to be around for a while. But we've had recurring ice ages in our relatively recent geological history. There's a chapter in the book about how human beings really evolved in a lot of ways because of two successive ice ages. You write that they come every 12,000 to 40,000 years, and maybe the next one is kind of on hold because of all of the carbon we've put in the atmosphere. My question is a little bit of global warming maybe a good thing if it puts off an ice age for a little bit longer?
Nobody really knows how to answer that. You know, if there was a way to freeze the world's climate into this interregnum between ice ages that we Homo sapiens have enjoyed, and it's allowed us to get a civilization based on agriculture going, you know, you might say, yeah, that would be advantageous. On the other hand, you know, given that this has allowed us to create all this agriculture, and all this agriculture has allowed us to grow all this food, and then to come up with ways of growing even more food because we learned how to synthesize, you know, nitrogen fixation with fertilizers and all that, and we've created this extremely populous species because there's been so much food to eat, then at a certain point, you know, we're kind of eating ourselves out of house and home, and now we're going to start to collapse. So I'm not sure that it's really a good thing ultimately. I think that any time you know, nature's kind of a cycle, and any time you stick something in the spoke of a wheel that's going around, you create some damage. So
We have, you mentioned how the human population has increased during this interglacial period. We have 6 billion people, 6 billion plus people on the Earth right now, and that will probably go up to 9 billion within our lifetimes. Are you somebody who believes that overpopulation is a problem to the environment? Because there are a number of environmentalists, people like Bill McKibben, who argue that it's not. And
I'll have to correct you on that one. Bill McKibben wrote a book called something like Maybe One.
He did, but I had him as a guest on this show, and he said that overpopulation was not something we had to worry about. What we had to do is cut back the amount of consumption that we do as Americans. He said the Earth certainly couldn't sustain 9 billion Americans with our consumption and lifestyle, but he seemed to think that it would level off at about 9 billion people and then maybe start going back the other way. But, to me, overpopulation, if you just look at the spread of human beings and how that's changed the world and how it's crowded out so many natural ecosystems and caused the extinction of so many animals, it seems obvious that that is a problem, and it's a problem that nobody seems to be talking about.
Well, you know, I bring it up at the end of this book, and I didn't really intend to when I got into doing the book, but at a certain point, it just became logical when I did the math and I found out that every 4 days there's a million more people on the planet. I mean, obviously, to support us, I've already mentioned the food that it takes to feed a million more people every 4 days, but you've mentioned our lifestyle, our consumption, our energy consumption. There's no question that we have grown out of balance with the rest of nature, and we're pushing things off the planet now that sooner or later we're going to push one thing too many. I mean, we may already have done it with our bats. We're losing this incredibly important pollinator and insect devourer that has kept the ecosystem as we've all grown up with it.
Frogs are going extinct, too. It's like we took out the large animals in the early part of human development. Now we're going after the small ones.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we don't know exactly what we did to invite in the virus that's doing in bats right now. With frogs, we do know what we did. We brought a frog over from Africa because we used it in laboratories as part of a pregnancy test. And it was a carrier of a virus that didn't affect it, but when it got out into the wild, that virus did affect the native frogs of the Americas, and that's all the way through the Americas from your lakes in Wisconsin
right
down into the tropics.
Well, Alan, I want to we're down to our last couple of minutes here, and I'd like to ask you one last question.
Sure.
What hope do you think we have? We've got a new administration in Washington, but every one of its environmental initiatives right now is being fought tooth and nail. The Obama administration released a report on the climate saying global warming is real, it's happening right now, and already I'm getting emails with right-wing talking points calling it scaremongering. Here's another headline I got in my email box today. Geologist rips Obama's new scare report. I become more skeptical every year. I now am beginning to conclude that global warming simply does not exist. With this kind of entrenched opposition, do we really have any hope of turning things around?
Sure we do. The entrenched opposition can make a lot of loud noise, and they can send out an awful lot of broadsides electronically. But ultimately, we have got the tools. They're not very... It doesn't require a lot of sophistication. We've got the tools to measure how many people do they really represent. How many scientists, for example, are really standing up against the consensus of scientists who believe in global warming? And it turns out that it's just a very few, and most of them are the same names that come up over and over again. And a lot of them are retired people who have not kept up with the research or don't want to see their years, their entire careers thrown out because of new information. So the overwhelming number of scientists no longer are having a discussion because they know where the science is headed. And The
and I guess it's up for authors like you and journalists to make that fact known.
And, you know, and people like yourself. I mean, we talk about it, and we try to explain it in the clearest, most seductive, you know, ways that we can, so we get people's attention.
And, you Ellen,
know,
again, Ellen,
I,
you've
know,
certainly...
I wanted to write a book that was going to be a bestseller to talk about this stuff.
You did it, and it's a great book, and you've gotten our attention, and hopefully you'll get the attention of a lot of people this Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair. Ellen Wiseman, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
I'm Glenn Moberg of Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producers, Kelson Quisler and Scott Clark. Special music today from The Doors, Skeeter Davis, The Fifth Dimension, R.E.M., and Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. A reminder that our Ideas Network hosts will be broadcasting live from the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair all day tomorrow, starting at 9 a.m. We also invite you to stop by and visit our Wisconsin Public Radio booth. Thanks again for riding with us today. Until we meet again, we are heading out of town.
Happy trails.